Welcome to the Men of Eight Gang podcast for Saturday, October 17th, 2009. This is Steve Borsch, and I'm on with Tim Elliott.
Hey, I like your music.
Thank you. Graham Thickens, somewhere up north in Minnesota or Wisconsin or something.
Yeah, on the shores of Bay Lake. Rutgers Resort, near Deerwood.
Fabulous. And yeah. Phil Wilson from Lakeville.
Yes, well, see, there's all this lake thing that all ties it all together.
Yeah.
Excellent. How you guys doing?
Pretty good. Well.
Good. Great, thanks.
Excellent.
I want you to know I've been holding off having beer at the Oktoberfest here just for you guys so I don't sound too slurry on this one.
Thank you for your sacrifice.
I'll have one when we're done.
All right. All right. Well, hey, so all of us have been fooling around with Google Wave this week, and I know that a couple of us, you're on, Phil, with the Twin Cities Wave Users Group.
I guess that's what they called it.
Yeah. And then we've been, and Tim, you set up one for today's podcast, which was kind of interesting. And Graham, have you had a chance to fool with it at all?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah?
Looks cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm curious. You know, Tim, you've been doing a lot on it initially. What are your initial thoughts?
It's interesting for collaborative stuff. I'm surprised that there's so many Twin Cities people that are on Wave right now. And that it I think it will spawn a lot of collaboration where email really doesn't really lend itself to that. But I don't think this is any kind of replacement for email either. It's something completely different.
Yeah. I think it comes down to also simplicity. And right now, email is such a simple task, especially for everybody. There is a bit of a learning curve in navigating through Google Wave. Now, granted, we can't really pass judgment on something in such an alpha state, but I think it's probably not going to be a replacement for email unless it gets a whole lot simpler, a whole lot faster.
Yeah, I would agree.
Go ahead, Tim.
I was going to add, I think that it needs mobile integration before it's really going to take off.
Agreed.
Yep. I'm wondering how it's going to affect tools like Basecamp and all the other hundreds of collaboration software tools out there. That's what I'm wondering. What do you guys think? Have any of you used Basecamp or similar tools? Well, I know you've used OnePlace or played with it, right? Steve,
I've used OnePlace. I've used CollectiveX. I've used Basecamp with three different clients. So I feel like I know the collaboration space fairly well. And here's kind of how I looked at it. I didn't see this as any kind of a replacement because most of the collaboration sites have enough structure and framework internally, and they have, you know, project management, Gantt charts, things like that, calendars, internal messaging, in OnePlace's case, they've got like a Twitter-like functionality. So I don't really see this as a replacement. What I started to think about, though, when you said that, Graham, in an email or something, or maybe you did it inside of one of these waves, is I began to realize that the opportunity exists for interoperability with collaboration. So you could potentially drag and drop little widgets from your collaboration engine into a wave that you're working with others on. It would be a little window into the API, into the data that's in there. It feels more like that than it does any kind of a replacement.
So you're thinking that the Basecamp guys are working right now to build some sort of connector to Google Wave, huh?
I would be.
Yeah.
I would be, absolutely.
We'll have to ask Steve Kickert what he thinks of it. Yep. As relates to OnePlace.
Yeah, he'd be a good one.
The founder of that company, yep.
Well, tomorrow, Julio had mentioned that there's some, that he had interviewed me or asked me for some initial thoughts. There's going to be something in the Pioneer Press tomorrow on Google Wave with some people that have weighed in on it. And I don't know. But what do you guys think about the activity and trying to make sense of what's what?
What do you mean? The activity in the sense of what as it applies to Google Wave or just in general?
No, just in general. No, just as it applies to Google Wave. Because, I mean, here I'm looking at the Wave that we put together for the Minivate Gang podcast, or that you did, Tim. Thank you. You know, already it feels disjointed that maybe it should have been broken out by topic. And I don't know if Tim's...
It's difficult to navigate. And the more people that you get involved, yesterday I spent a little time with the quote-unquote Wave users group. I don't know if they want to stick with that. But, you know, there's over 100 people in that group. And there were probably a good 15 to 20 on at one time. And there were things happening all over the place. And it was very difficult to follow. Now, granted, it was a whole bunch of people saying, oh, what does this thing do? And let's do this and let's do that. So there were a lot of different things going on. So it may work better when you actually have a focused topic. But yeah, I mean, the screen is only so big and you have to kind of scroll up and scroll down because people can edit in or respond in anywhere during the wave. And you could conceivably miss something.
Yeah, I don't think it's cut out for groups of 100.
No.
You know.
No.
But that raises the question, you know, what is it good? Is it good for small teams then? Or what's the take on that? Four or five people at a time or what?
Well, when I was looking at this Google Wave group and how they built the blips, so there'd be little sections that are self-contained. What I was struck by was, this is going to sound like a really weird analogy, but remember the old dot matrix printers that would, or the impact printers that would print on that accounting paper, the I forget what they call it now, the green stripe and a white stripe. And
yeah, the green stripe paper with the holes on the side.
Yeah.
Feed paper. Yeah.
Right. And how that separation of the stripes allowed you to, at a glance, know what you were looking at. And that I think is the big challenge here is trying to break it up and have somebody manage the blips. So, you know, like we did with the podcast, I put in a topic about something about topics. Well, then I didn't even reply to my own thing. So it wasn't in self-contained inside of that blip. And it's stuff like that just doesn't make sense. I know this is hard to maybe get across for people listening, and I'll try to maybe do a graphic or something in the show notes. But
I think the thing that people that are listening that don't have any experience with Google Wave, don't worry, you're not missing anything yet.
Yeah, no kidding.
You're not missing anything. So, I mean, it's an interesting sort of thing to play around with right now, but it's very early and it's iteration, and I think we'll have a lot more to deal with it later on down the line. But right now, it's kind of interesting. Let's just say that.
Yeah,
I just noticed that one of my buddies out in San Clemente, California, set up a wave about surfing. So he's trying to get surfers to talk on.
Get it? On wave surfing. Get it?
Yeah, surfers live the life they love and love the life they live. Free and easy. These are the free and easy surfers. They don't look much different than other people, but they live differently. To them, the most thing in life is the sun and the surf. This is what they enjoy. This is what they live for. Well, thank you. I did not know that. Oh, and then there's a Jack Johnson thing in here. Yeah, this is pretty cool. I'm just really starting to get into this, you guys. I'm starting to like this. Oh yeah, he's got videos in here. This guy's a maniac, Darren McClure. He's the man.
So how did you find that? How did you find that?
It just popped up on my on my thing on the left side, whatever that thing inbox. There you go, my inbox.
So somebody invited you to it. That you were on.
And I must have answered. I must have accepted an invitation, which I don't remember doing, but. But yeah, there's some surf videos in here, and oh god, he's got all kinds of stuff in here. It looks like he's only got about two or three other people talking on it right now, though. But he's posted all kinds of stuff.
If you notice in your contacts, Wave is meshed with your Google address book. So as people that are in your regular address book on Gmail show up on Wave, they will show up on the side.
Oh, they will. I don't have to accept an invitation, and they'll just show up over there.
Right. So someone that you're connected with on Gmail saw that you were on there and just added you to that wave.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cool. He might have asked me if I had an invite, and I told him, but I do recall doing that. Now, he was at Blog World, so I'm surprised he's had time to do all this. In fact, Blog World's still, in fact, going on, isn't it?
Yep. Sure yep. is.
Yeah. All day today. Yeah. See, I just got a DM on Twitter from Meg. She's actually can be on now, if that would work.
Sure.
All right.
Sure. It's one of the topics that Steve wanted to address was libraries in the world of new and interactive media and how that's impacting library, business overall. And Meg Canada is the person that we know we can talk to about that.
Well, that's why don't we segue, though, on one of your topics that Steve deleted, which is...
Hello, Meg.
To kind of do a postmortem of Unsummit.
Oh, sure.
That would be perfect.
That Steve deleted.
Can you accidentally? Meg, can you hear us?
I can. I'm actually going back out to the car where I heard the acoustics are perfect.
Great.
Well, there you go. Oh, well, yeah, but that trip out there is a real mother.
Yeah. You know, one thing about the iPhone is it's very noisy.
Yes, it is.
Oh, come on. You guys be nice now.
Super noisy.
I think wind affects the iPhone more than anything else.
You know what I think the best sounding phone is?
Mm.
The Trio 650.
I have to agree with you. Thanks, Rick. Tim. You're a fine human being.
We try to throw you a phone every once in a while, Phil.
Thank you so much.
Great. Well, Meg,
we were going to segue over from, we were just doing a little talking about Google Wave, and I know you're part of that group as well, and we were just sort of discussing Google that. Wave. You love the Google Wave?
I do. I think it's a lot of fun. I'm really excited to find a practical purpose.
Yeah. Hey, Meg, even though all of our listeners probably know who you are, why don't you say who you are and what you do and why you're connected with us here today on the podcast?
Well, my name is Meg Canada. I am a senior librarian and web services and training for Hennepin County Library. We're a 41 library system. And I also coordinate the social media efforts at the library. In my free time, I enjoy working on projects like Unsummit, attending social media breakfast, and I also co-chair NetSquared, which is an effort that's put together by NetSoup and helps nonprofits with social media and technology.
And I understand you also collect spiders. No, I'm kidding. I'm teasing. No.
You see, this is the problem. This is the problem that we have with doing this in the afternoon. We give Steve way too much time to drink. Oh, yeah. So.
No, it's the bong.
And I should tell you that I'm talking to you today from my mom's car in Gary, Indiana, in front of the Gary Teachers Union, where I've been helping her stuff envelopes and make door signs for the annual Quest conference here.
What a great daughter.
Hey, I used to live near there, Meg. This is Graham. I went to a couple years of high school, played football at Calumet High School. Kind of in between Gary and Hammond. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, my mom teaches right next to Wirt at Marquette Elementary in Miller.
I'll be darned.
Yeah, it's a small world. Kumbaya.
It is a small world. Well, anyway,
Say we could all sing the Gary, Indiana song now.
No, let's not.
I remember how it goes.
Oh, you don't know how it goes.
Librarian for me.
No, what we can do is we can talk about Stephen King's book, The Stand, where the crazy fire starter went and blew up Gary, Indiana after all the people died. So,
anyway. Did anyone else find it odd that they made their last stand in Las Vegas?
No, I mean, that's where all evil resides, right? And it stays there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, this is not going anywhere where I thought it was going to go.
I know.
So speaking of Blog World being in Vegas. So anyway.
So how did Unsummit get to the Library Central, whatever
Central,
you call it?
Central Branch.
Central Branch,
we were looking for a venue, and obviously our first time around, we met at the Local, which is a pub in downtown Minneapolis, and that was a great choice for the 50 people that came, but as we've grown and doubled and now tripled in size, we needed a bigger venue, and I was able to get the library to chip in the space for free, so it was a good fit.
It's a great space.
Is the space at the library available to any groups if they get in and chat with the library, or do they really need to know Meg Canada?
Many of our spaces are available for free for nonprofit groups or meetings that are open to the public.
Okay.
The spaces at Central, specifically that we have Unsummit in, the Doty Boardroom, our KMC, and Pullat Hall, all have a cost associated with them for outside groups.
Okay.
But there is wonderful space, as many of you who attended social media breakfast may have noted the last meeting at the Brookdale Library. That space is available for free. The space at the Brookdale Library. Southdale Library has a large meeting room. So those are good choices.
And I wish there was one at Eden Prairie, but not enough space.
There is one. It's just a smaller space, and it's very frequently in use by the library for programming. So okay. They do their story times and
different
programs.
Well, you had it's great to have you on, Meg, and you had responded when we were doing the live podcast at OnSummit, and I made a comment about the fact that, you know, we don't have any estrogen on the panel, and also it would be great to have, you know, just other people, because we're always trying to open this up as much as we can. And I had come across, and I'd sent this to you, I'd come across an article on libraries and broadband in 2009, a woman named Ann Tracy, who writes for Blandon on Broadband. The Blandon Foundation funds this rural broadband think tank initiative, and she kind of runs the blog and so forth. And it's just a really interesting article about the state of technology and funding in U.S. public libraries in 2009. And the stats were staggering. I mean, 71% of public libraries report they're the only source of free public access to computers and the internet in their communities. And as I read this, and then I also saw another article talking about discussions going on with the FCC and also with Congress about what it would cost to run high-speed pipes into libraries and hospitals or the major medical clinic in rural areas throughout the nation. It would be between $8 and $10 billion. Are you seeing, or what's happening at the library level with respect to the shift going on from the Dewey Decimal System and those physical things called books and made out of atoms, and the shift to digital bits on the net?
Well, our circulation has increased over the past 10 years. So it's not that books aren't still our business, because they definitely are the focus of our business for our customers, from our customers' point of view. But I think actually talking about meeting room space is an interesting segue, because certainly the gathering place that the library is becoming is a different one than it was 10, 20, 30 years ago. Certainly the library is no longer an entirely quiet space. Technology, we thought, would be about personal computing, sitting in front of a computer quietly typing away. And we've learned from our young adults and teens that they like to congregate around computers, share a screen, talk around a screen, work together. We are also trying to make the shift to digital and downloadable material, and we do have two different vendors that offer downloadable audiobooks and ebook, as well as some music and movies.
Well, what's been interesting is I told this story actually at the Minnesota Public Radio Citizen League event they had now almost 2 years ago, but I'd gone into the New Eden Prairie Library to get a reference, to look at a reference book, because you can't check them out. So I went to the library to look at a book, and I was struck by the fact that no one else was. I mean, there were probably 75 people in the library, and they were either on the computers or like you just described, huddled around the computers, and or they had their own laptops there using the Wi-Fi. And I took my laptop and the book over and I sat at a table and I got connected. And I looked up and there was this young Somali, what I assumed was a brother and sister, kind of the way they were sort of giving each other crap. And I was struck by, you know, how really attractive they were, you know, just as people. You know, Somali people have very fine, thin features. But then I was realizing, oh my God, just about everybody in here is in this section was Somali. And I thought they're coming to the library for digital access because they probably don't have it at home. And you know, it's just an assumption. But how great that was to have that kind of a resource, which, by the way, the net access is really fast, which is great. But
then, I'm glad you had a good experience with our Wi-Fi.
Say that again. I'm sorry.
I'm really glad you had a good experience with our Wi-Fi. We're slowly moving the remainder of the Minneapolis libraries to the HCLIV network, and everyone will have the same Wi-Fi access by the end of the year. And we do also allow wireless printing. So folks who have a laptop but don't have a printer can come in and print.
Oh, wow.
It really is a shift in the kind of services that we're offering. And we do recognize that we are a community center and a hub for activity, and that we need to offer those cultural activities that appeal to the community.
So what happens in a time when, and you guys jump in, I feel like I'm asking all the questions. I'm really fascinated by this because when I look at Google Wave, and Tim, you put something in there about the Google Chrome OS, and I want to talk about that too. But this morning I was out walking the dog and I came across this link on Twitter by a guy I follow about this Wired magazine article about YouTube's bandwidth bill is zero. Welcome to the new net. And they referenced the Credit Suisse article this past summer that estimated that YouTube was binging on bandwidth and Google was losing $500 million in 2009, because now they're up to 100 billion videos a month. But a new report from Arbor Networks suggests that Google's traffic is approaching 10% of the net's traffic and that it has so much dark fiber optic cable that it's simply trading traffic with no payment involved with the net's largest ISP. So they're basically serving that stuff for free. So now you think about, okay, well, they're doing all that with video. They're scanning all these books. They have all the search, obviously the search capability and all the analytics that are going on behind that. And now they're, you know, basically putting out this collaborative, connected, real-time container called Wave, and all of that is really wonderful. But when I think about the library and library science, who makes sense of everything? Who puts it into categories? I mean, who helps people seek and get the right results?
And I think it's the last part that matters. I don't think it's about organizing information anymore, because I do think, you know, with the way that data is being delivered and set up and scanned, that it's about findability and giving people those critical skills of how to find information. It's not that it's not available or that it's not in the certain place on the shelf. It's about how to find it.
Well, it seems like everybody is coming out with an ebook reader, a digital ebook reader these days. And I know Barnes & Noble is partnering with Google on their editions, which are, you know, basically digital books. How is the library adjusting to that? I've heard that the New York Library is buying Sony ebook readers, and they have a digital lending policy. Do you see that as a future of libraries, is that you'll, instead of having physical books, you'll have digital books?
Some libraries are loaning Kindles. Some libraries are loaning iPods. We have libraries that are even lending flip cameras. You know, it's interesting when you get into devices as opposed to print books. Playaway players, which are sort of one-shot audiobooks, are being loaned around the country. I don't think we have a good answer yet in terms of our business model. Maybe our business model will have to change, but with format issues, and particularly with DRM, for example, there isn't an audiobook right now that I can listen to, or a movie format that I can watch on my Apple. And you're not allowed to do it in the library because we have a restriction that you can't download those particular items in the library because we don't have the bandwidth. We can't support it. And those are problems you run into. Bandwidth is a huge issue in the library. When we do hit our peak hours, things can move very slowly. So that is an area where we need to continue to improve.
Well, you know, the one thing that happened to me this past week is I met with the CEO of this startup company, and we got into a deep conversation about demographics and psychographics and the kinds of data that he was looking to get so that they could go to their next investor pitch with the kind of data they required so they wouldn't get the crap beat out of them again like they did the last time. And we got into this discussion about Forrester and Gartner and IDC or IDG, I think, that have these, you know, $3,500, $4,500 reports, and how people leap on the press releases by Compete and by Nielsen, and even Gartner and Forrester, when they kind of do the 40,000-foot view of what you're going to find in their report. And people leap on that because everyone's so hungry for the researched data. And is there, I don't know, the Hill Library does some of this in the business space. And yes, you have to pay for access.
I wish I could say we're buying those.
I was just going to ask, I mean, it's you know, I just think about all the things that are out there, even the cutting edge papers that are published in the higher ed space. God, I would just love to be able to get access to any of that stuff.
You are not the first person to ask me if we purchased those reports. Certainly, I'd love to say we did. At this point, we don't have access to them. It's not an easy thing to distribute.
Because they probably license them, right?
Copyright and fair use and you know, how we would loan them, and they're not always bound. You know, a lot of times they're electronically available. So hopefully, eventually, one of our vendors like ProQuest, Gale, EBSCO will begin to carry those kinds of reports. But a database vendor is really our best bet for that kind of information.
Well, in the future, do you think that the library will be into a lending model, or will it be more just you know, kind of services to find information, more of a research sort of function?
It's a really good question. If it's a research function, I think it needs to be more of a collaborative than an information gatekeeper. We aren't sitting behind our desks doing research for people as much as we're helping facilitate. And as I've mentioned before, I see the role of the public library changing dramatically to really focus on what we do well, which is helping parents with early literacy, offering sort of that entertainment and ongoing lifelong learning, reading opportunities, but also doing more facilitation like book clubs, discussion groups. One of the things I'm excited about is the idea of affinity groups. And I think of Unsummit or social media breakfast as being an affinity group, offering space and having people meet around an interest. And whether that's an academic interest or a business interest or even, you know, a social or entertainment interest. And then having the infrastructure to support that so that there is a projector in the room and there's great Wi-Fi and people can bring their own computers or use ours and collaborate.
Are you, is the library doing more in the training space, you know, in terms of actual classes on, you know, how to get started with this cloud computing category or how to start blogging or any of that? I mean, are you doing any of those sorts of things?
I actually coordinate public learning and training at Hennepin County, and we offer over 300 basic computer classes a year. I'm sorry, 600, excuse me. Over wow. 600 basic computer classes each year. We have two full-time instructors. And they're still teaching high-demand classes in Word, PowerPoint, Excel, but also Intro to Social Networking. They've taught an Internet Trends class, how to add multimedia to PowerPoint, and Open Office, Write, Calc, and Impress. So okay. We are stepping into that space. But we certainly are not offering the more advanced classes because we have such a demand still for those basic classes. What's interesting is to look at the programming that's done for teens and young adults aged 12 to 18 because we're finding that they do not want to come for a traditional sit-down class. However, we're developing methods like just-in-time training for those groups to learn things like Scratch, which is an MIT product that's open source that's used for kids to develop games.
Okay.
And write gaming kinds of things, or things that are more tools they might use, but again, would not sit through a formal class. So just-in-time training might involve having different kinds of instruction cards and walking around and offering them when a question comes up, having kids collaborate on a project or an assignment, and then helping as needed, but not standing up in front of a group and giving a formal presentation or having them follow along step by step.
Well,
seems like that's kind of going by the wayside.
Can I throw out a use case? Because this is something I've always wondered about. So now here the library is dealing in a time when the internet is disrupting much of the physicality and the destination sorts of things that we've been used to in the past, whether it's a newspaper or, having to watch a television show and sit through the commercials, you know, whatever it happens to be, is that we're very, very, very quickly shifting to this just-in-time or on-demand world. And I was really struck and had to smile when I looked at WordPress.tv and saw that initiative. And so that was one thing. So I looked at what WordPress is doing to say, hey, let's let people put training videos up about how to do all sorts of different things around WordPress, and we can put up the WordCamp videos and things of that nature. And I've been seeing some very professional screencasts that people have been doing there. So let's put that aside for a second. Now, I've been accessing it, of course, on my computer, but also I've got this Mac Mini hooked up to a HD TV, and I've been sort of having this window into the future of internet video and access to it. And I began to realize that with Fora TV and with this idea site that does interviews with people and all of the various offerings that are out there that are very phenomenal content, I can just access whatever I want, whenever I want, and just go grab it. But in a day when the library is still a physical destination with augmented with online stuff, how aggressively is the library moving more toward a virtual model? And what does that ultimately mean for the library in the next 25 years?
It's interesting because our website still gets lots and lots of hits. We're sending people to selected websites, to databases. People come to us virtually in much higher numbers than they come to us physically. However, if you look at the universities, a lot of their books are being discovered through Google or through other places. So while we design these online libraries for local use, more and more, I think things will continue to move the way of the single interface, the single search discovery tool. And as we try to build tools that will help our customers or patrons, we've tried very hard to make the catalog more multifunctional with RSS feeds, for example, for searches, with author alerts that allow people to receive an email, or we're working on a text message if a book is added by their favorite author. We have built a social network for library users called Bookspace, and it's open to anyone anywhere in the world, but definitely has more of a Hennepin County focus.
Okay.
And it lets people put their photo up, have that personalized experience, and make their own book lists and share them.
How long have you been doing that? That's the first I've heard of that. How long has that been in existence?
2007.
Huh.
February 14th. I love Book Day.
Is it built in Maine or what?
No, it's actually built in Cold Fusion and SQL. And it's available at bookspace.org.
Huh. Interesting. How many members now?
I know we have over 10,000 active users.
Wow. And most of those are in Minnesota, but not all, huh?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct, because anyone in the world can use it. And you can attach your library barcode number to your account so that when you log in, you can also comment on items that you've checked out. We were one of the first libraries in the country to the first library in the country to allow comments in our catalog. Huh. So that people can write their own book reviews and share them with others directly in the catalog interface.
So this may sound really strange, but I just have to say it anyway. When I think about the library, I think about it as a place that houses resources, and it's a repository of knowledge, or at least pointers to where to go get that knowledge. And the one thing that I've really been struck by is the unbelievable challenge it is to find anything related to, for example, startup companies that have Web 2.0 hosted apps in the cloud. I keep coming back to somebody at some point needs to, accelerate a directory service of some kind or whatever. So I can go in, if I'm a consumer, I can go into, a place where I want to find online backup solutions and all of them are there. Or I need to transfer gigantic files to other people. So yeah, you send it and Drop.io and all of these other services, but where do I go to find those services? How do I even know they exist? And then how do I use them? I think about that because it's not just library and knowledge and resources being shifted to the net and processes being shifted to the net, but also people participating in the workforce means they have to shift to the net and do more. And there really isn't a good place. I'm blogging for Scholastic, the K-12 publisher, and I'm really into the K-12 space mentally, deeply embedded in reading all kinds of stuff. And I got to tell you, for the most part, the students in K-12 right now are not being prepared for a world where they're going to be always on, always connected, participating socially, and accessing resources online. It's just not happening.
And I think that is more about teacher orientation and also resources that are available, whether or not there are computers in the classroom, whether or not they're using mobile or Palms to deliver assignments and pass that information around. They are not as connected. And we do have a lot of students that come in and still are told by their teachers, you need to find a book. And a database, which may be the replacement for a book in a library, is not acceptable.
Really?
So that is a challenge. Yeah, that is very much a challenge that we face. That there's still this orientation on the part of parents and teachers that a book is a better resource.
Kind of follow on.
We have very authoritative sources.
Yeah, to follow on that, what about Wikipedia? Is that seen as not a good source?
I think that Wikipedia, when I talk to students about Wikipedia, I tell them that it's as good as the Encyclopedia Britannica, and chances are your teacher does not want you to use an encyclopedia for the assignment. They would
exactly.
like to find some other sources.
Yep.
You know, it is reliable. There are times when it may have been graffitied or defiled, but the chances are it's just as good of information as you're going to find in a traditional reference resource like an encyclopedia or a dictionary or whatever it may be that you're looking for. However, chances are your instructor wants you to look at a biography and get some more in-depth resources from a science database or that kind of thing.
Well, and I got bitch slapped on an article that I had two links in it to Wikipedia for this post that I did for Scholastic. And I got two different emails, actually, about that particular post and why in the world did you link to Wikipedia? You know, that's not a trusted source, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, okay, so you tell me where the resources are that explain what a rich internet application is, and I'll be happy to link to it, because they're just not there.
And find the resources that have that information, but also that are in a free and open format, because I could probably show you those resources, but they would be in a database that requires some kind of authentication, whether it's a library card that's registered in Minnesota or another state. So the ubiquity of Wikipedia makes it an easier source. And we do internet messaging reference. We answer questions via IM. And there are two ways we do it. One, we do it locally. And two, we do it with a consortium. So I answer questions for OCLC Question Point, which I'm assigned to do once a week. And so for 2 hours or 2.5 hours, I'm answering questions from all over the country, and in some cases, the UK. And when that happens, and I get a student who comes on and needs help with homework, I have to find sources that aren't going to be limited by whether or not you have a Hennepin County library card.
Right.
And that gets more challenging, because then you have to find things that are authoritative and that have the appropriate annotations and that are current. And that gets to be much more of a challenge when you get a question like, okay, so I need information about what the ancient Greeks wore in the arena. You know, that becomes a situation where you're looking for something that's open and easy. And Wikipedia is very easy in that regard. But what I usually do is I direct students to the sources at the bottom of the page.
So what is the next thing that you are working on as it pertains to the Hennepin County Library and its participation either in social media or just the interactive space in general?
I think pushing social media out to our individual libraries, trying to get them all active on Flickr, thinking about teaching staff about Twitter and the other applications that are out there. We Twitter as the library, as one library. We also have one Facebook page. So thinking about how to make it a larger effort on the part of the whole enterprise.
Are you finding that, it used to be whenever you needed an answer to something, you always called the library. Is that moved on to the digital space as well? Are people emailing you, texting, tweeting, asking for, what's the answer to this? Yeah.
Absolutely. We get IM, we get phone calls. We still get some mail, email, comment forms, blog post comments. There are a variety of ways you can reach us, and people choose the way they prefer and get through to us quickly.
Interesting.
How big is the staff, Meg? Give us an idea of the Hennepin County Library staff and how much of it is downtown versus, what did you say, 41 libraries?
We're 41 libraries total. That includes the Central Library. We have about, I believe it's between 700 and 800 staff people.
Wow.
Total. And there are 14 libraries within the city limits, and then the rest are in the suburbs.
Meg, can you give us an idea? What is the source of funding for the libraries these days?
The county. Hennepin County is our major source of funding. We do have a library foundation, and we do have friends groups as well.
Is there anything that you see on the horizon as far as the digital space that can generate revenue for the library to keep operating expenses up to date and, manage those better? Will you see a revenue stream from this possibly?
I guess I don't usually think that way because we don't think about generating revenue at the library. We think about providing services.
But in a world where funding is being cut on a regular basis, and we always hear the stories of libraries having to shorten their hours and issues there. I mean, isn't there a little bit of an onus on you to figure out a way to help keep those programs going if funding is cut off?
Perhaps there is. I will tell you that we aren't offering any programs that don't fit within our operating budget, though. We don't actively seek grants to support our ongoing operations because we don't want to create something that we can't sustain for the community. We use grants to try new programs, but so in terms of a revenue stream, I can't really give you anything with that.
It's not necessarily a priority.
No, it's not.
Yeah, I was just going to say, so Meg, nothing, it costs anything? Like all the training you were talking about earlier, that's all free? Or don't you charge nominal?
It is all free.
It is.
We do not charge anything.
Wow.
All of our classes are free. All of our programs that are open to the public are free. We have a couple partnerships, namely with the Loft Literary Center, where there might be a cost associated with a class, or Community Ed. But in those cases, they are often renting the room, not providing the program as a library program.
I see.
Was that available to anyone out in the area or just people in Hennepin County?
Anyone who can come to a program is welcome.
Wow.
Anyone in the state of Minnesota can have a card with their home library and register it with Hennepin County.
You don't let any Wisconsin people in, though, do you?
Oh, no.
That's a joke.
Well, I think, Meg, are you finding that there are a lot of people that don't even know that some of these services are available or a lot of these services are available? Because when I go into libraries, there are many times that I walk into a library and go, I had no idea they did this.
It happens to me all the time. Yep.
And it seems like in tough economic times, people rediscover the library.
Yeah.
It seems to be a time when people are recognizing the value that they get in coming to the library and using our resources, whether it's our computers, our wireless, television in some cases, music, books, 5 million books, CDs, and DVDs in 40 world languages, 1,750 public computers. So it's a lot of resources that are available.
Well, and then there's the stuff like Rosetta Stone, which was available, and we
and
came.
Do you want to know why Rosetta Stone is no longer available?
I would, but I just want to tell you about how disappointed I was that we were all geared up. We went over to Eden Prairie, and the woman said, "Oh no, we just sent it all back."
And the reason is that Rosetta Stone stopped offering their product to libraries.
Right.
They decided they were making enough at the mall and the airport. And that they no longer wanted to sell to the library market.
Yeah. Well, because they lose customers.
We do have a new program for language learning called Tell Me More. And there is a class that's associated with that. So you may want to check the classes for this winter.
Well, there you go. There's an ad. You got that snuck in there. Good job.
It is
Thank
good.
You.
You know what, though?
I'm taking the language class that is Yell It Louder. Have you heard that class? That's a really, just to learn a language. Yell It Louder.
And you're doing well.
What?
At that.
What? What? What, Phil?
Which library to go to for that one.
Where is the bathroom?
That's right. Actually,
Fancy County.
That's the ugly American language course.
It's the ugly American language course.
I hate to say this, but my dad and I went to Germany in 1997 to find out where my great-great-grandparents had come from. And we were having breakfast at this bed and breakfast, and the woman didn't speak any English at all. And so that's... My dad was doing that. He was speaking slower and louder.
Yeah, I said, they'll get it. Don't worry.
And I looked at him and I said, Dad, it doesn't matter how loud you speak.
Come on, we're American, damn it. They've got to understand us.
So I one of the things that I'm wondering about is, first of all, I love the Minnesota Historical Society. I mean, I just have this affinity for it and love to go poke around there sometimes when I have time. And they, my family, one of the cousins, was Thomas Meehan in Forestville, and now it's a state park. And I offered him some photos at one point. And so I started interacting with somebody, and I ended up telling him about Shorpy.com, which is this great historical photo site, and said, well, wouldn't it be great if you guys would tweet photos or do a blog and put photos in there? And they said, well, as a matter of fact, that's exactly what we're going to be doing.
That's a cool idea.
Well, so here's what they did. I mean, first of all, I love seeing their tweets because it's always something topical and delightful. So when the whole balloon boy meme exploded on the net, they did a tweet about a guy named Jean Picard. Yes, similar to Jean-Luc Picard, a guy in Rochester that flew away in his own balloons in 1937. And they had links to photos. And I just thought, how incredibly delightful, because it absolutely, every time they do this, they just grab your hot button. Or the day that it snowed on the 12th or something, they did some blizzard photos. And I think about that with the library is the sorts of things that even Garrison Keillor does on the Writer's Almanac. Minute or the Writer's Almanac. Yeah. I listen to that, and it's a 5-minute little snippet of a show that he does, but he always talks about on this day, you know, who is the writer and what happened. And, you know, it's almost like, Paul Harvey's The Rest of the Story sort of thing. I mean, it's really, really intriguing. And so, Garrison Keillor has my mind share. The Minnesota Historical Society has my mind share. And the library doesn't. And I ask myself why, because I would think I'm the perfect customer.
Well, okay. So there's a couple of things there. We do tweet about upcoming events. We tweet about current events if possible. For example, we did an H1N1 flu guide that we posted, and I did put that both on Twitter and Facebook. Facebook, we have over 1,500 followers. I posted things about the state fairs, Library Day, where with the library cards you got a discount, and where the patent was for the Tilt-A-Whirl being from Faribault. And so we do try to post that kind of relevant information that's topical and interesting. The one thing I wanted to say, though, was, so you talked about donating some materials to the Minnesota Historical Society.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing you have to remember is that the public library's role, the central library does have a role that's archival. And we do have a special collections department with those wonderful gems of Minneapolis, old journals, old yearbooks, that kind of thing. But for the most part, your public library is not a place that is going to archive the local history the same way a historical society is.
Mm-hmm.
We're a different kind of gathering place. We're interested in teaching parents of young children the 6 early literacy skills to make them succeed when they get to school, and helping adults who want to learn how to email for the first time to learn those skills. So it is a little bit of a different focus. But we do have excellent librarian blogs on our subject guides. If you go on the website and you click on reference and research, you'll see those. And there are some good updates there. But I'll work on some more topical things for Steve.
Okay. Well, guys, this is, we're kissing up on our hour here. So I just wanted to kind of wrap up. We had probably 30 topics today to talk about. We didn't get to all of them, but.
Well, that's, you know, we didn't get shushed once by Meg, and she's a librarian, for gosh sake.
You're right. Well, she'll probably send us DMs, though. And now, Graham, you can go drink beer.
Yeah, and watch the Gophers beat Penn State. I wish, I hope.
Yeah.
Well, it looks like I just know, I saw a tweet that Iowa beat Wisconsin.
Oh, really? Well, that's always good to hear.
I have a former library volunteer who's playing for the Gophers right now. Adam Leake. Go, Adam.
Yay.
Cool.
Excellent. Well, guys,
I hope
the weather is nice down there, because it's really nice here today. It's only in the mid 40s, but it's just gorgeous. The sun's out, and I hope you guys have a great weekend. Meg, thank you for being on with us and putting up with our obnoxious sort of selves.
I believe that was thanks for putting up with my thanks for putting up with Phil here. Is what it said, what he's saying.
No. I love you, Phil.
Go ahead and say it, Steve. Just go ahead and say it.
All righty. Well, thanks, guys. Have a great one.
Have a great one.
Thank you.
Hey, you
Take
too.
Care. Thanks, Meg.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye.
I know just what to do, baby.